I used to study really hard for exams. So it would always begin 2 to 3 months out where I would make these wall charts where I would literally draw a calendar of every day I had until the exams, which were marked in red. And then I would block out in 30-minute intervals, not just subjects, but like if it was geography, I'd have like volcanoes and then plate tectonics and then the Cold War. And these war charts were absolutely massive. I mean, they occupied like the entire bedroom wall, and I'd cross them off as I would get through these individual topics. And my mum used to joke that I should submit these things as coursework, as an art project, because they were so detailed and color-coded. And I'm even like embarrassed to admit that I had pink post-its for free time. Like, that's how ordered and structured this process was. And these super detailed plans were going to get me straight A's and into Oxford. I liked certainty. I deeply resisted doubts. I didn't like not knowing, period. What grade am I going to get? And what will I do after school? And then my degree? And where will I live? And who will I date? I hated not knowing the end of the story. I mean, I really hated it. Not knowing how things were going to turn out or what was going to happen, even in the next few hours, made me feel physically anxious. I needed to know. Doubt was a force that wore me down. Chasing certainty was a way to control my anxiety. Or so I thought. As you can probably tell, we're mixing things up on today's episode. Instead of coming to you as the host, Rachel Botsman, interviewing guests about their rethink moments, I'm coming to you as me, Rachel. Today on Rethink Moments, how the power of doubt can transform the way that we live and lead. What happens when we let doubts creep in? And how can it change our relationship with uncertainty? From about the age of 7 or 8, I dived into a swimming pool for the first time. And I don't know why, because I wasn't like a child that was in the water a lot growing up, but I just discovered I physically was built to swim, and that if I trained, for whatever reason, when I dived into the water in a race, I could win. It was a very strange feeling to know that you had that kind of strength and power in your body. And there was something about swimming that it's a sport that you do alone. It's really good for introverts because your head is down, you're following a line. You know, I used to find it very meditative because you're just going up and down that pool. You don't really need to think a lot. And I spent hours doing laps to win these races. And you sort of find like you get to club level and then you get to county level and then you get to national level, but there's no end point. Like, where have you become successful? You just get pushed further and further. And so these things were going on where I realized that if I had this structure and this order, I could win. And that's how I started to perceive what it was to be capable and to be successful, was to be very controlled and disciplined around a process. I think when I look back, in some ways, it inhibited my ability to learn because I was trying to get the grade. I was trying to memorize things. I was trying to beat the system, right? So I realized, like, if you downloaded the papers, it was a game that you were playing. But that isn't really conducive to being curious. I wasn't the student who sat in the classroom and just sort of looked confused and was happy to admit that they didn't understand. I was the student that had to prove that I always knew everything. So I look back and I think that it was kind of not a missed opportunity, but it's a shame that that's the way the education system works, is to drive you to that end point, to drive you to that result, because you can't sit in a space for very long where you don't know the answers or you're just curious about something and you can explore. But it's funny, the one place where I was like a complete mess, I mean, like so messy, and I could live in this place, was in the art room. I mean, the art teachers had a designated corner because I was like, it was just a tip. I'd never tidy up. There'd be pots of paints everywhere. I'd, you know, walk around school covered in paint, and the teachers sort of accepted it. So I always thought it was really interesting that there was one side of me that was comfortable being completely messy, and there was the other side that was so strict and disciplined and controlled. I think there was a change in that. It was when I finished school and I was not pressured, but the voice definitely from the school, I should say the advice was, you should go and read law, right? You should go and read one of these big subjects, PPE, like politics and philosophy and economics. And, you know, I sat the exams to get into Oxbridge. And I remember going up for my interview and there was this art school over the road. And I remember the people walking out of there and they just looked really relaxed and happy. And I remember looking around and thinking, the people around me don't look relaxed and happy and we haven't even started studying. So maybe this trajectory of doing law or English isn't a great idea. The school thought I was crazy, right? Because I had the grades to do, you know, these other subjects. And I remember going into the art school and I was really lost and baffled because, you know, my peers, there was only 20 of us and most of them, it's really incredible. When I look at that year group, they've all gone on to be very successful artists in their own right. But they never showed up to class on time, right? Like the guy who was next to me was a guy called Conrad Shawcross, who's now a famous public artist. And I never saw him in the studio because he never overlapped with me. So I was always in like at 9 and I'd finish at 5 and try to apply the same process that I'd applied at school and realized it didn't work. Like that was not how creativity happened. And that was incredibly confronting because it was the first time in my life where just memorizing stuff and like plowing through a curriculum wasn't going to create the things that the school wanted to see. It wasn't the way to be conceptual or to be creative. So it was a real moment of not change, but observation that there was a different way to live and to be and to study and to immerse yourself. So I think that was a very important fork in the road. So much of my work was focused on the physical object. And so I found very early on that I loved making sculpture. They call it installation work that responds to a space. And it was really interesting because whenever I received feedback, which was criticism, my reaction to that would be to always add something to the piece. So I'd assume that something was missing. And I had this incredible tutor called Jordan Baseman. And he said, Rachel, I've made this observation that you're so focused on the physical thing, the positive object. And whenever I give you feedback, I come back and you've added something to it. You never take anything away. And I'll never forget this conversation I had with him because I realized I had never learned how not to do something. The swimmer in me, the person that made the wall charts, the person that knew how to give the definitive answers, was all about doing. I'd never learn how to cope with not knowing and how to take things away. And here it was showing up in my work. And he introduced me to this idea of negative space, which is very common in design and art, but I'd never really understood it before. And when he first said it, I was like, well, is a negative space a negative thing? And he said, no, what you need to learn to look at is not the object, but the space around it, the empty space, because that space is what holds all the power. It's the empty space that defines what the work is. And at first, I have to admit, I thought this was like just, you know, art talk and a bit, I don't know, I don't even want to use the word that actually came to mind, but like it just felt a bit heavy and conceptual. And it took me a long time to understand this idea that my instinct to improve something had always been to add something. And actually, the way to do this was to take it away. This concept of a negative space, the ability to hold space. This is actually the very definition of capability. The definition of capability is capex, which means the ability to hold much. And I just think that is wonderful. What we're saying is actually the most capable leaders can hold a space. They can hold much. And in that space, you're going to have doubts. This is why I think doubt is one of the most underrated and misunderstood superpowers a leader can have, that we should be looking for this ability to be able to hold this space where they can sit with doubt.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
When I finished my second book, Who Can You Trust? I had just done a 3-week book tour of the US, and I think we'd done over 20 different stops. It was insane, and I was so tired. And I got on this plane to do the long haul from LA to Sydney. It's a night flight, and I always travel in this like daggy black tracksuit, you know, with like a hoodie. And I remember getting on the plane and I had to step over this woman, and I noticed her because she was wearing this beautiful cream silk suit. And I thought, who wears a cream silk suit to sit on an aeroplane for 14 hours? Like, this was the first thing that went through my mind. And then something went off in me that I knew this person, that I recognized them. And I saw this glimmer in her eye that she recognized me, but I couldn't place her. And it turns out that she'd been with me at university, but at university, she had been a man and she had a different name. And I suddenly had this moment of realizing who this person was. And I said to her, I know you. And she said, oh, I know you know me, but I was just waiting for you to have this moment. And so we started talking about what happened in our lives over the last 20 years. And she started to talk about how when she left the Ruskin, she'd gone on this sort of hardcore career trajectory like me. And then she embraced this principle of doubt and this idea of saying, I don't know. These three words has started to become her guiding principle in everything that she did. So she would only take jobs if she really didn't know how they were going to turn out. She took amazing roles in the creative lab at Google. She created like crazy theater productions. She won a Peabody Prize for reinventing what a book could be. And this whole thread through her work was this premise of not knowing, that she would go into situations where she didn't know the outcome. And I sat there like completely entranced, because I was like, this is who I want to be, right? I want to start doing things where I don't know the end result. I want to be comfortable in the uncertainty that, her name is T, seems to thrive in. And we had this incredible conversation and we started to talk about the idea of doubt. And I said to her, but I don't understand, like, doubt is such a negative feeling, right? When you doubt things, it feels paralyzing. When I think of doubt, I think of things like fear and anxiety and not knowing. And she said, yeah, but doubt is the birthplace of creativity. Like, this is where new things come out of. And literally before she fell asleep, she said, but what would a world without doubt look like? And I couldn't get this question out of my head because I'd never thought about it before. Like, if doubt didn't exist in the world, if people didn't question things and question each other and question information, like, what would the world look like? And that felt like this really pertinent question. And you know those moments where you just have never thought about something in that kind of way and you can't shift it, it sticks with you. And I always think that's often identifying something deep in yourself that you want to change. So I started to think more and more about this tension between the greatest creative minds that have the capacity to really embrace doubt. And it always bothered me, like, often in when I was giving talks, there would be some guru or someone giving a self-help talk on never doubting yourself, that this idea of self-trust was, you know, getting rid of doubts. And if you look at like many brilliant minds and writers, Sylvia Plath being one of them, they'll say, you know, doubt is the killer of creativity. And that's, I drank the Kool-Aid on that. And then I suddenly realized, like, this was the wrong way of looking at it, because the way I had defined trust for over a decade was a confident relationship with the unknown. So actually, to have trust in yourself, you have to have a really high capacity to doubt things. And as soon as I made this connection between trust and doubt, that doubt actually could be a very healthy thing, and there was a distinction between the paralyzing doubt that had scared me growing up, so the doubt that makes you anxious and the doubt that is kind of like that downward spiral. And then the doubt that T was talking about, which is productive doubt that can lead to new thinking and help me move forwards and discover new things. I started to understand that actually doubt was one of the most curious and powerful forces that we have in our lives. If I said, what does doubt mean to you? What people will say is their associations with doubt are often negative. So they'll talk about emotions, fear, anxiety, frustration, sadness, even maybe depression. And it's interesting when you look at artworks of doubt, it's like someone taking hold of your life and it looks really dark and you're sort of trapped and you can't move. Like that's the paralyzing form of doubt that can be incredibly destructive to people's lives, where they cannot move through anything because they doubt themselves so much. But there is another kind of doubt, which is productive doubt. And that is the space where we can still think and function in a healthy way, but our minds are questioning things. I am completely fascinated by the root meaning of words. And the root meaning of the word doubt in Latin is dubiter. And dubiter means to hesitate. Hesitation, again, is not a negative thing. This productive form of doubt is when we slow down enough before we make a decision to really say, what is missing here? What am I not seeing? Why am I hesitating before I make a decision? Should I trust this person? Do I believe this piece of information? So there is a type of doubt that is a healthy kind of friction that can hold us in a space where we bring in more viewpoints and look for different kinds of information and challenge our assumption and challenge our biases. And the reason why it's productive doubt is because we move through it. We don't stay in that space. We come out the other side. And when we come out the other side, we have a better idea or a better answer, or we see things more clearly. And that's why it's productive, because it helps us move forwards. So productive doubt helps us move forwards, whereas paralyzing doubt keeps us stuck or even drains and pulls us down. Once I started to see that people that really trusted themselves, incredible entrepreneurs that I've met, leaders, creatives, what set them apart was this ability, this remarkable capacity to be comfortable in the unknown, that they weren't lost, but they could sit without knowing the outcome. They could be comfortable with their doubt because it would lead to deeper questioning. It was like a healthy hesitation that pushed them in different directions. They were the people I admired the most. It's interesting, if you look at studies done on the qualities that people admire in leaders, so what are the qualities we want in our leaders? So Pew did a study, a big study on this. The number one quality, understandably, is honesty. The second quality is confidence. And on the surface, I can understand why people would rate those qualities. But when you think about it, for someone to be honest with you, let's take a political leader, they have to be able to express doubts. If they are giving you false confidence, if they are pretending that they have answers when there aren't no definitive answers, if they're rushing to give you a decision, it's a form of dishonesty. So actually, there's a really interesting partnership between honesty and doubt. And I think we'll know that we've started to really make a shift and reframe and rethink the concept of doubt when people start to actually say, I admire a leader that can stand up there and say they don't know, or that they haven't figured it out. And that isn't a weakness, and I'm not going to hold that against them. That is them being honest and direct with me. It's really hard to reframe ideas when, from such a young age, society has reinforced a different concept. I think the reason why we are neurologically wired to chase certainty is because we like to measure things in results and time and profit and with awards, and that becomes the benchmark, the yardstick of so many different areas of our lives. So this idea that you say to people, you know what, there's this space and it's called productive Tao, and it's all about your capacity to be able to live in the unknown and to really embrace uncertainty. It's not an idea that sounds very appealing, right, at first, because you've been told not to doubt yourself. You've been told that doubt is the force that will hold you back and will get in the way. Changing your mindset and embracing something that can cause discomfort is incredibly difficult. We have to retrain and rewire ourselves to actually be comfortable with doubt. And this is so powerful to develop in ourselves, because if you get comfortable with doubt, you will be more comfortable with uncertainty. Rethink Moments is created, written, and executive produced by me, Rachel Botsman, and Will Hain. One of the best parts of creating the show is getting to collaborate with a brilliantly talented team. This includes Anushka Tate, our incredible audio editor, Kat Davi, our producer, and Phoebe Adler-Ryan, our researcher. Thanks also to Nick Morbath at Evolution Studios, where this podcast was recorded, and Alex and Ben Sampson, who came up with the theme music. Thanks also to Matt Hill, Danny Linder, and Karenza Metric, who all played an important role in making this show happen. Rethink Moments is part of the LinkedIn Podcast Network, so big thanks to everyone there, especially Jesse Hempel, who's been a kind champion of my ideas over the years. You can follow Rethink Moments on Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at Rachel Botsman. If you haven't already listened to other episodes in season one, I'd encourage you to check them out on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And please do leave us a review, because it helps other listeners find the show. To keep rethinking with me, please sign up for my newsletter at rachelbotsman.com. I hope you enjoyed this special episode and that it's got you thinking differently about doubt.